Welcome back to the program. As we watch the Olympics unfold this week and see that oftentimes less than a tenth of a second separates gold from loss, we realize that the mental game, what goes on inside the athlete's head, is almost as important as all of the physical training. How do athletes stay focused, not only in the moment, but through the years of often tedious training? And what does the mental conditioning do after winning or losing? We're going to talk about all of this in the context of fighting with my guest Sam Sheridan. He joined the U.S. Merchant Marines after high school. He attended Harvard, from which he graduated in 1998. He's written for Men's Journal, Newsweek, and Fight. It is my pleasure to have him here to talk about his newest book, The Fighter's Mind, Inside the Mental Game. Sam Sheridan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, and good morning.
Is fighting different than any other sport, or is the mental process, what goes on in the head, similar to other athletes?
I think it's similar, certainly, but it also is different. To me, and I think to most people, fighting, you know, there's a little bit of a gray area there. It's a little bit morally ambiguous. You know, how safe can you make a sport that's about hurting someone? You know, your goal, you don't score points, you knock someone out. So there's a kind of a moral ambiguity, and there's dangers in fighting which don't exist in the same way, and not just physical dangers. Sure, you can get hurt in football, but you know, it's different. But I think what that allows for is a kind of clearer view into this world of the mental game, because the stakes are so high. I mean, it's so personal, it's so intimate in a way. It's very revealing. You know, you have two guys basically in their underwear up in a cage or up in a ring, and they're exposed, and their personalities, their minds are on display as much as their bodies, you know, because you really do see their courage and their gameness and the qualities, all kinds of other qualities are revealed in what they do. So there are a lot of similarities, but I think just, you know, only more so for fighting.
For fighters, is there the realization that it is somehow different, that it is more raw, more exposed, or did they try to put themselves in the position of other athletes?
Well, you know, you can't really generalize, because a lot of fighters are coming from different places. So there are certainly fighters, for instance, who come from, you know, Olympic wrestling backgrounds. And for them, it's much more like a version of Olympic wrestling, only now you can punch somebody in the face. It's just, you've changed the rules a little bit. It's not emotional. It's much more about competing, and that's the language they use. That's how they kind of control the fear and the anxiety and the rage and those issues. And there are other guys who come at this from a very different place, you know, who come at this from a street fighting place or from just a need to fight kind of situation. And for them, you know, it is emotional, and they do fight on emotion, and it is very personal. So, you know, there's all kinds of different guys doing it.
How much does a sense of what there is to lose, physically, mentally, how much is that part of the equation?
It's huge. I think it's not so much, you know, what you're going to lose physically. It's the fear of being dominated. It's the fear of being, you know, completely controlled and overwhelmed and made to look foolish on a huge stage. And, you know, any fighter, almost any person in the world will take a couple of punches and a couple of cuts if they get to win the fight. You know, if you get to win and raise your hand and raise the title belt or however it is at the end of the fight, you'll take, you know, some stitches, you'll take some brain damage, it doesn't matter. So, you know, it's that fear of social domination, of being controlled on such a big stage, and I just think it's the natural genetic evolutionary, you know, fear. You don't ever want to get dominated by another man. You know, you just don't. It's one of the most basic instincts we have.
What have we learned in terms of brain research, and what does modern psychology tell us about all of this that's different from 20, 30, 40 years ago?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I think these things have come around in circles, even though we talk about them differently. I mean, in my book I found, you know, which was a surprise to me, but very strong parallels between the study of Zen meditation and the study of the zone in modern sports psychology. Now, that may not be a surprise to anybody who knows anything about those things, But to me, it was a bit of a surprise. I hadn't really looked at either, and to me, it was a bit of a shock that you know, you have this this practice, a thousands of year old practice, you know, refined by Japanese swordsmen in the 14th, 15th, 16th century, and a lot of the things they talk about have come back around in sports psychology with this idea of the zone and flowing in the zone and being in the zone, which, you know, every sports talk radio host in the world knows what that means. So it's interesting to see how these ideas are cyclical and they've come back around.
And for fighters, how much time do they spend thinking about this aspect of it?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, too. Again, you can't really generalize because there are so many different kinds of guys, but I do think fighters think about this a lot more than people know. I mean, I think the wrong time to interview a fighter is when he's about to fight or when he's just fought, you know, because, again, going back to this idea of the zone and guys who can be successful in the zone, they're away from their conscious minds. Their conscious minds aren't interfering with their reactions and with their physical knowledge. So it's not the best time to ask them some complicated questions about how they think about things.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean they never think about these things. I think, you know, fighters have a lot of downtime. All professional athletes have a lot of downtime because you have to rest and you have to take care of yourself. And those thoughts do come around. And, you know, it's precisely how you deal with things like fear and, you know, dealing with losing, dealing with winning, that define success in sports and in fighting in particular.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about, particularly with regard to the fighters that you profile in the book, the fear of getting hurt, the fear of physical pain.
Well, certainly physical pain, like I said, is not a major part of this. The fear of getting hurt is a part of it. The fear of losing, you know, is a huge part of it, the fear of being dominated. And, you know, it's that catch 22. You know, you were talking about the Olympics. You know, you work for 10 years for something, and it's all decided in 3 seconds. You know, and it's how you deal with that pressure is precisely what allows you to be successful. So there's the catch 22 of that kind of performance. And for the fighters I talk to, you know, guys like Randy Couture, who's a very famous Ultimate Fighting champion, or Dan Gable, who's a great wrestling coach. You know, a big part of dealing with success was putting that fear away. You have to accept that you can lose. You know, you have to accept that possibility. Freddie Roach, who's a famous boxing trainer and trains Manny Pacquiao, who's one of the great boxers of today, he talked a lot about that because he had been a fighter who, you know, he had been a pretty good fighter. He'd been almost a great fighter, but never a great fighter. And what happened was he ran into a guy he couldn't overwhelm, and he couldn't accept that he was vulnerable. He couldn't accept that he might lose, and it really kind of broke his style. He couldn't adjust. Whereas Manny Pacquiao, one of his most famous sort of charges, you know, has lost, but accepts it and deals with it and accepts the ways to fix it so it doesn't happen again. I think the guys who can do that and can learn to do that. One of my friends said, it's like you take a bunch of rocks out of your backpack. You can perform so much better without this crippling fear of failure, as long as you can accept it on a certain level.
That mental toughness among the fighters you talk to, is it something acquired or something that some of them are just born with?
Well, that's an interesting, there's a lot of different answers to that. But, you know, Greg Jackson is a very, very famous mixed martial arts coach for the cage fighting stuff. And he and I talked a lot about this. He came from a very rough background in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And he really maintained that mental toughness, you know, can be taught. Some people are tougher because of their background or, you know, they're just naturally tougher. And some people are a little less mentally tough. But everybody can get tougher. And I think one of the things I really saw in fighting was that a lot of the guys who come from a hard wrestling background in junior high and high school and college, you know, are mentally tougher. And that's because collegiate wrestling and Greco, Olympic wrestling is very much about mental toughness. You really work on pushing people to their breaking point and pushing yourself to your breaking point, so you know where it is and you understand what it means to break. And also, you know, when you get beaten up and you're exhausted and you can't breathe and you think you're going to die, you can, if you've been there a few times and you realize you didn't die and you don't have to die, you don't have to quit. I mean, certainly the first time you get there, you quit because you think I'm going to die. But after a couple of times getting through that, you push it back a little bit. You realize that's a decision to quit right now. I don't have to do it. I'm not going to die. So I think the short answer is mental toughness can be acquired. I think you have to really work for it. It can't be, you know, taught on a treadmill. It doesn't come from a aerobics class. You know, you have to really push through your boundaries, but it can be done.
What impact do interpersonal relationships with friends and acquaintances, loved ones, what impact does that have on these fighters?
Oh, it's everything. I mean, interpersonal relationships, you know, have a tremendous impact on everyone, I would argue. And I think, you know, particularly the relationship of a trainer and a fighter, we all know it from boxing and from the boxing films. It's a very, very intimate father-son relationship, which of course is and also tied up economically. I mean, a trainer only makes money through his fighter, and yet he doesn't take the risks that his fighter is taking. Obviously, he's not the one getting punched in the face. I think, I forget who it was, but a famous fighter once said, you know, I have the bravest manager in the world. He doesn't care who I fight. You know, that's kind of the joke of it. But nonetheless, I think it is a very, very close relationship, and managing that relationship is a very tricky minefield. If you look at the boxing fatalities, most of the boxing matches that have ended in someone getting killed are the common denominators is the father is in the corner, is one of the trainers for the fighter that gets killed. So and doesn't, you know, he's sort of doesn't have the right attitude towards his own son, his own flesh and blood, is somehow pushing him too far, or trying to live vicariously through him, or not accepting that his damage is real. You know, so that there's interesting, tricky minefields that play a role in this kind of realm where the stakes are so high.
And of course, the reverse is true, with the son trying to prove something to the father that he might not try to prove to a trainer.
Right, absolutely. That's very true. And they're both so emotionally tied up, they're not seeing the forest for the trees. You know, that's a very good point.
I mean, it's a little bit like what we saw. I mean, it's not fighting, but a little bit like what transpired with regard to Tiger Woods and what's changed in his life since his father died.
Right. Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, and they always talk about Mike Tyson and Cus D'Amato. Cus was a very venerable, sort of old-fashioned trainer, and, you know, he sort of kept Mike on a straight path, and when Cus died, a lot of people feel like Mike lost his rudder, lost his compass.
Talk a little bit about how all of this has been caught up over the years, and you have lots of quotes in the book, in the lure of fighting, the literature that's been written about it, the journalism in particular written about fighting.
Well, you know, it's an easy metaphor. You know, it's there's you right in the face. It's an easy way to examine human nature. Again, I think one of the reasons fighting is so popular, I mean, there's an old joke that if you have a schoolyard and in one corner there's a basketball game and in another corner there's a volleyball game and in the other corner there's a fight, everybody's going to go watch the fight. You know, I think one of the reasons fighting is so compelling, whether it's boxing or mixed martial arts or anything, is you do see these traits about human nature very, very clearly revealed. You get to see courage on display. You get to see fear overcome or not overcome, and you know, it's more real than reality TV. It's the most sort of primal emotions manufactured for consumption, and what makes it relevant is that they're real. They're not fake. I mean, these guys are really going through this, and they're really, you know, facing near life and death situations. So I think that has a lot to do with what draws writers to it. It's an easy thing to write about, and it's a compelling thing, and it's a a lot of fun, and the subjects, you know, the fighters themselves are so interesting because they sort of straddle this realm. They're of society, but then occasionally society's rules are completely suspended for them. You know, they get to fight somebody and hurt somebody, and they're paid to do it. And there's this tremendous approach of that day, it makes them into sort of crazy people, but also really interesting and really they have to be intelligent, and they have to be thinking people of a certain kind. You know, so I think those things, the incredible depth of the subject matter, you know, the near poverty of a lot of the participants, and just the grittiness of it, really make it for a great subject.
Talk about that they have to be intelligent and thinking of a certain way.
Well, you know, it's nobody gets to be good without being it. You know, nobody you ever see on TV really is a dummy. I mean, these guys, they have to be in the gym, they have to be working all the time, and they have to kind of find a way to keep improving. Certainly champions, certainly great fighters, have a tremendous amount of intelligence about what they do because, you know, there's just a lot of money in it, and if they're not thinking, they're going to get beat by somebody who is. And you have to think your way through these problems. You know, it's easy, again, to put these guys into thuggish categories, but, it doesn't hold up when you start to scrutinize it.
It's also easy sometimes, and literature has done this in movies over the years, is to romanticize them.
Oh, absolutely. No, it's a brutal business. Like I said, these guys are a little crazy. You know, it's not anybody who does this professionally, I don't care how nice a guy they come across as. Randy Couture, for instance, he's sort of like a wonderful human being, and he's a very noble guy. But he also makes his living and chooses to beat people up, you know. And it's those things can't be divorced from each other. Mm-hmm. You know, there has to be a way to tie them together and understand the complexity of someone who chooses to do this professionally.
And because of that, can we apply the kind of rules and principles of mental toughness that are part of the fight game to other endeavors? Does the metaphor hold because it's such a crazier kind of endeavor?
I think it does because, you know, we're all facing challenges. We're all fighting something, as Hensel Gracie, who's another very, very famous fighter, said, you know. And I've had guys write me about, dealing with disabilities, just getting out of bed in the morning if they're getting into a wheelchair and the battle they go through. And that was kind of part of the inspiration for this book, was that, you know, I've had mothers, you know, write me about getting the kids ready for school every morning, you know, and how that's their fight or whatnot. And I think, you know, you can take something from these guys who have been tested to such a level and been in such deep waters. I think it does apply to almost every facet of life. My wife is a director, she's really enjoyed the fighter's mind, and because she's able to take lessons from it for her directing and for her friends who are also directors, to, you know, dealing with defeat or dealing with success and then defeat. You know, there's all kinds of very complicated emotions that I think fighters experience maybe in a more clear way, but all of us feel.
Is grace under pressure part of it?
Well, grace under pressure, of course, is again one of those defining characteristics, and it goes back to that idea of the zone and of Zen meditation. It's of not being so afraid that you get in your own way and allowing yourself to kind of perform at a very high level. And I think it's interesting that you know, there's in a lot of Western conceptions of the martial arts, there's this what I call the Karate Kid idea. You know, you can learn a little bit, and as soon as you accept the right philosophy, boom, you're a master, and you can defeat 50 enemies. And we all know that's kind of bogus. And what they're forgetting in that is, of course, that, you know, Memento Musashi and all these guys who wrote these books in the 15th century devoted a lifetime of study first to their art. So, you know, after you've been studying, you know, kendo and sword fighting for 20 years, then you need to get out of your own way. Then you need to find peace and become tranquil and not get in your own way. You can't just not get out of your own way first. You know what I mean? So there's no shortcuts to mastery, I guess, is what you learn about this stuff. And, you know, it's just about getting in the gym for every day for 5 years, 10 years, and then the mental game becomes really, really important.
Sam Sheraton, his book is The Fighter's Mind, Inside the Mental Game. It's just out from Atlantic Monthly Press. Sam, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.